As I began to work on this sermon, I found that the topic which I had chosen, the shrinking man, came to reflect my own mental emotions, perhaps more than it did the subject matter of the sermon. As I pondered the personal implications of much that I might want to say, I began to feel that a preacher had either to be foolhardy or a bachelor in order to freely express himself on a Mother's Day. I grew to understand the wisdom of a professor of sermonics, of homiletics, whom I had at the Hebrew Union College. He was filled with practical advice as to the subjects which we might cover, days and special occasions of Jewish and of general life. And I remember that when he came to Mother's Day, he suggested to all of us the best sermon we might preach would be to get a guest speaker for that occasion. And he followed this up by telling us a story which is told originally by Dr. Abraham Meyerson, a noted neurologist in New England. It deals with the angel of death. Now, this particular angel of death was in the habit of making a personal pickup for each one of his new guests. And one day he was called to the bedside of a particularly beautiful woman, and he fell in love with this woman. Instead of escorting her to the tomb, he escorted her into his nether world and there took her unto him as wife. And the angel of death and his new wife had a child, a man child. And they raised him in this world of ours. And he became in time a doctor. And he was uniquely suited for this occupation because he had a means of diagnosis which no other practitioner of the medical arts had. He never lost a patient. He would walk into the sick room, and if he noticed there his father standing by the bedside and no one else could see his father, he would simply say that this case isn't in my particular specialty, or that this case is so far gone that there is nothing that I can do for the patient, and would walk out. Or he would walk into a room, and when he did not see his father there, he knew that the patient would get well, whatever he did. And he would take the case, and his percentage of recovery was 100%. But one particular day, this doctor, this young man, the child of the angel of death and of this mortal wife, walked in, as had his father, on a young lady, most beautiful and comely, with whom he fell immediately in love. But there was one difficulty. His father was standing at the head of the bed, and he knew that this young woman was doomed to death. But because he had fallen so immediately in love, he said, "I'll take the case." And his father shook his head. "Your reputation will be ruined. Do not take it. I'll take it." And he walked out of the room, and he went to see his mother. And as the story goes, the next morning, he went to visit his newfound love, his new patient. And there was his father, standing at the head of the bed, his head hung sheepishly, his shoulders sagging in defeat. One visit to his mother, the wife of the angel, and all was right, and the two were married and lived happily ever after. So I hope that all of you will accept gently the words which I will try gently to speak this morning. Mother's Day is, of course, an invention or a creation of the luxury trades. The flower people, the candy people, the perfume people, the jewelers devised Mother's Day as a means of increasing their sales. But despite its commercial origin, I think that Mother's Day has come to occupy a uniquely important and sacred place in the lives of many of our families. Because it gives those of us who are fortunate enough to have our mothers and wives still with us an opportunity to express the largeness of our love and of our respect in some small way, with some small verse or words or gift, for the largeness of the devotion and of the protection and of the sacrifices which they have over the years given to us. Now, a mother's love is, of course, a pure love. It is given without thought of return. No mother would ever ask her son or daughter to balance the scales. And yet each of us realizes that we must do a great deal for our mothers in return. Not out of obligation, but out of love. And in a society such as ours, where fortunately the lifespan is lengthening each year, where we are increasingly blessed by having mothers and grandmothers and even great-grandmothers still with us, we ought each of us to take it to heart on a day such as this, to see to it that the lives of these mothers are filled with busy concern with our own lives and our own future. Now, there are, of course, mothers whose domineering ways make it difficult for their children so to do. But if we search our hearts, each of us will realize that there have been times when we have allowed the petty routine cares of our daily life to so occupy us, to so fill our every waking moment, that we have not taken the time to call up, to visit, to be with she who is most precious to us. Most of us only fail through negligence because we are careless. But every once in a while, there is a son or a daughter who is willfully negligent. And she ought to, or he ought to, be brought up sharply by such a day as this. When we were students at the Hebrew Union College, we made it a practice to visit the old folks' home in Cincinnati at least once every other week. The administrator there had a list of the patients who received the fewest callers and the least mail. And many of the students of the college would come and spend some leisure time of theirs with these particular patients to make them feel some link with the outside world, to fill their hours with busy, pleasant talk. One day I went in to see a woman whom the director had told me had received only 3 letters and not a single visit in the last 12 months. I tacitly assumed that she had no immediate family, only if perhaps a few distant relatives. But I was rudely shocked when in the course of the conversation she informed me that she had 3 children and 6 grandchildren. Now, they lived in other cities, but to this day I cannot imagine how these 9 people could find only 3 short, brief occasions in their life to sit down and to even write a note which they knew would bring such joy, happiness and warmth into their mothers' lives. Each and every one of us must on this Mother's Day reaffirm our obligations to fill her life with pleasant companionship, with the joy of sharing with us the glorious future which she planned for us and built for us and helped make for us. This is in part the message of Mother's Day. But this morning, if I may, I would turn your attention to one of the basic tensions and adjustments which face the modern American home. The first lesson which we talked about is self-evident. But this adjustment and this tension is so pervasive that I think some of us forget that we are living in a generation which has shaken the roots of the average family as no other generation of man has ever done. For ours is the generation which, for the first time, has seen women come into their own. The classic social revolution of the 20th century is the emancipation of the woman. She has won her independence. She can compete with man in the world of politics and of business. There is no longer a dichotomy, a division between the business world, the man's world, and the home, which is uniquely and solely the woman's world. We have only to think of the old marriage vow, in which the woman was asked to pledge that she will love, honor, and obey, to realize how greatly our whole mental set has changed as to the role which our women should occupy in this new life which we are building. This is a great social change. It's taking place in the West and strangely taking place at rapidly and sometimes more rapidly in the East. Russia, China, India have all taken giant steps forward towards ridding their society of the purely patriarchal family. We are on the verge of a bright new future in which women will be given the opportunity of enjoying their own life, of making their own future, of determining what areas of life they will concern themselves with, their careers, their families, their education, whatever it may be. It is all open to them, and we are grateful that this revolution has come about. Up till now, in all of Western civilization, it was the man who was dominant. It was a man who legally and socially had structured life so that his decisions in the area of business, in the area of politics, in the area of the church, of the synagogue, were dominant and preeminent. Now, this is not to say that women, exceptional women, did not and could not compete successfully with the man. And this is not to say that often a man who appeared as a Caesar to the outside world was really a puppet controlled by the strings of his wife. This is not to say that women were not loved or respected or revered. They were. But it is to say that in Western civilization, up till the last century, a woman's place was generally considered to be in the home. She was not encouraged to be educated. She was not encouraged to develop whatever cultural or artistic talents that she might possess. Her testimony was not always accepted in the courts. She could not sign, in general, a financial transaction and have it held to be valid. Her wills as to marriage were controlled by her father. She had no or little say in the matter. And we must remember that this was the basic pattern of Western life up till almost our own day. Jewish life offers us a good example of the status, both positive and negative, which women held. You will find no greater devotion to the woman, no finer, keener portraits of the woman than those that are drawn in the Bible. And there the women are not limited to feminine virtues, domestic graces. They are praised because of their loyalty and of their love and their strength and their courage and their character, the very characteristics for which men are praised. We have only to think of Ruth and Naomi, of Esther, of Deborah and of Hannah, of Rachel and of Leah, of Rebecca and of Sarah, and of the many other women whom the Bible pages bring to life, draw for us keenly and beautifully, to see how deeply respected women were in our ancient faith. And the Bible, after all, does contain what is perhaps the greatest and most beautiful tribute ever paid to woman and mother. It is that great poem with which the book of Proverbs closes, a poem familiar to all of you, and yet one worth the rereading each year, I think, on such a day as this. A woman of valor, who can find? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, and he hath no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is yet night and gives food to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. She girds her loins with strength and makes strong her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good. Her lamp goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She She makes for herself coverlets. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates where he sits among the elders of the land. She maketh linen garments and selleth them and delivereth girdles unto the merchants. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the law of kindness is on her lips. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and she eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done valiantly, but thou excellest them all. Grace is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman that revereth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. Surely a civilization which could produce such beauty had love and respect and devotion for their women. And yet, as we search Jewish practice, we can see how legally and financially and educationally women were definitely relegated to a subservient position. We have only to think of the dramatic change which such a service as this symbolizes. Today we have had women on our altar lead us in worship. We are sitting together in our pews, families, man and wife. This could never have been in the ancient synagogue. It was a male-structured organization. There were only men rabbis, and only men judges, and only men led the service, and only men counted for the minyan, for the 10 required people for a service, and the women were either relegated to a partitioned area in the rear or to the balcony. We have only to think of such an occasion in Jewish life as confirmation to realize again the dramatic change which has taken place. At confirmation time in our temple, the young boys and girls of our religious school come to our altar, there to be blessed and there to accept the responsibilities of adult Jewish life. Up till the last century, there was no confirmation, only the bar mitzvah. Only the boy had a ceremony, a ritual, in which he accepted the responsibilities of Jewish life. There was no such occasion in the life of the young girl. An indication again of how far we have come towards balancing the opportunities which are offered to both our young men and our young women. Now this change, so dramatic, is all to the good. All of us relish in the fact that the many talents and abilities and capacities which our women have, which they were granted to by a just and kind God, can now be put to the fullest and most beneficent use. Our society, our nation, our city, our families are the better for their opportunity to fulfill themselves in personal achievement outside the home in areas which were heretofore closed to them. None of us would turn back, if we could, the clock of time and reestablish the older ways. And yet I know, that as we consider the tensions of modern life, many of us recognize that the emancipation of the woman has in some strange and fundamental way shaken the very cement which binds the family together. We know that it has created great tensions and the need for new patterns of adjustment in our society, new adjustments which we have not necessarily yet successfully achieved. Think of the burden which now is placed on the shoulders of every wife and mother. She must balance career and marriage and family. Heretofore, her path was clear and straight before her. There was a cake of social custom which told her where she must go and what she must do and how she must apportion her time. But now her time is in her own hands. She alone will determine its use. And I wonder if the statistics of the startling rise in mental breakdown, in nervous hypertension, which exists among our women may not be in part due to their inability to find the correct balance between their desires for personal achievement in the man's world and their ambivalent desires to fulfill themselves as always, as traditionally, through their family, through their husband, and through their children. Certainly the empty home, the broken home, are in part the products of this new emancipated woman, of the woman who has not yet come to the realization that she cannot have both emancipation completely and the joys and completion of the home life. That if she chooses marriage in the home, then she must invest of herself largely in terms of time, in terms of hours spent with her husband and with her family, that she cannot spend her whole life outside of the home and expect that her husband will continue in his full love and devotion, that her children will grow in their love and respect, and that she will find the completion, the fulfillment in her children, in their growing straight, strong, and true, which in part is the true fulfillment of any life. I wonder if the steady march of our middle class and upper middle class and upper class women to the psychiatrist's couch may not be in part due to their inability yet to balance their own heady desires for personal freedom, personal achievement, and the hard fact that marriage and the family impinge and constrict and limit by their very nature the freedom which she enjoys. This to me is the basic dilemma which the average American wife and mother must solve, and solve successfully. If she chooses completely to follow her career, then she ought not to attempt to raise children, because the statistics of the empty home, the statistics which we have seen in the studies of the children from war worker wives of the Second World War, tell us that young people raised without the attention of their mother, young people who lack the very love which is their basic food and need, grow up and tend to become aggressive in their reactions to gain that love and that attention which society and their parents have denied them. Somehow each of us in our own lives is going to have to find a new balance between freedom and obligation. You cannot be utterly independent in marriage, because marriage is a full-time partnership. This is the challenge of our 20th century. The rabbis said that there are three things which make a man's life as if it were a walking death. One is to be limited by a debilitating disease from which there is no hope of cure. One is to be forced to perpetually live off the charity of your community. And the third is to be cursed with a wife who is simply self-seeking, demanding and domineering, and who will not give of herself for her home and for her family. And there always have been in history such women. But until our generation, there were few of them who could break out and wholly find their own. And there were few others who could see the way clear to marching along their own way, self-seeking way, without perhaps thinking, out of negligence, not thinking of those in whom their true fulfillment lies. In part, their dilemma, our dilemma, is being successfully solved. It seems to me that the average young American woman and the average young American husband is finding a new balance between their business lives and their home. That they are recognizing again the responsibilities which marriage imposes upon them. that they are working out a new balance, a new modus vivendi between their outside of the home activities and their family responsibilities. And I think if each of us would keep in mind the truth which was revealed to Israel when it left Egypt, we would all gain some understanding from this Mother's Day. When the Jews left Egypt and escaped across the Red Sea, they found themselves free, liberated, but in a desert. They had dreamt for years of this glorious moment, of this time when the shackles of slavery would have been ripped from their shoulders and from their arms and from their legs, and they would stand again as free men. But they found that freedom entails obligations and responsibilities. And within a week of their being freed from Egypt, they were complaining to Moses, "Far better that we had remained slaves in Egypt than that we had been obliged to lead such a life as this, under such dangers and tensions as we are now leading in the desert." And it was only after Moses had led them to Sinai and there informed them of the self-disciplining law which any people in any marriage needs to adopt for success, that they were able to withstand the long 40 years of wandering in the desert before they came to the promised land. Such are our marriages and our hopes. We need to accept the self-limiting discipline of a well-thought-out and well-considered plan for the raising of our family, for the achievement and fulfillment and happiness and the growth of love in our marriage, if these are to be successful. And this plan we shall have to work out together, husband and wife. And if we do, the long desert wandering, which are the years of marriage, we will find in each day of that marriage, together, the promised land, which we all seek. Amen.